and meeting places can similarly be banned. You have to submit your agenda to what you're going to do with that meeting and so on. This is not a matter of incitement. There's already laws about incitement. You can incite someone to commit murder, incite someone to commit terrorism. These are already offences. It's speaking about matters which are not offences and they have no intention to make offences. So that's a very strange thing. That is, you know, this is not rhetoric that we expect to hear post-World War II in Northern Europe. But we're hearing it now.
WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange speaking inside the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he's taken refuge for the past 3 years. If he steps outside the embassy, he'll be arrested. To watch part one of our exclusive interview, visit democracynow.org, where he talks about leaked drafts of the TPP, that's the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the recent disclosures of a British nuclear submarine whistleblower who says it's harder to get through airport security than to get onto a Trident nuclear weapons submarine. And Assange talks about secret details of a European Union plan to use military force, in other words, blowing ships up, to curb the influx of migrants from Libya. That does it for our show. Special thanks to Dennis Moynihan, Hani Massoud, Mike Burke, Sam Alcoff, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Brendan Allen, Julie Crosby, Neil Shabata, and our London crew, Pablo Gargiulo, Jamie Goodbrand, and Izzy Montero. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. Next up is the evening news.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Storefront Review, produced by the Triangle Theater from May 7th through the 30th at the Sanctuary at 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. Storefront was a thriving theater company in Portland, which closed in 1991. Triangle Theater is bringing back some of the burlesque acts and performances from this bygone era. Again, that's the Storefront Review, produced by the Triangle Theater from May 7th through the 30th at the Sanctuary at 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard.
Hello, KBOO members. You are invited to attend KBOO's Mission and Vision Retreat on May the 30th from noon to 4 p.m. This retreat is an opportunity for members to support the development of a mission and vision statement for KBOO and to share your valuable knowledge about your community radio station. If you would like to attend the retreat on May the 30th, get in touch with Monica Beamer and RSVP by sending her an email at monica@kboo.org or calling 503-231-8032, extension 201. More details about the agenda for the retreat will be sent to you when you RSVP. We hope to see you on May the 30th and thank you for being an active member of KBOO.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Lent's International Farmers Market, a program of Zenger Farm, every Sunday at Southeast 92nd and Foster from 10 to 3. Opening day is this Sunday, May 31st. Lent's Farmers Market offers the Food Scouts Farmers Market for Club for Kids, a community produce booth open to home gardeners, cooking demos, and live music. More at lentsfarmersmarket.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Obama administration has announced a measure to restore provisions of the Clean Water Act to protect small waterways, including more than half of Oregon's streams.
A rally is planned for tomorrow outside of a mosque in Phoenix, Arizona, by anti-Muslim protesters.
And we'll take an in-depth look at today's city council meeting, where some citizens were shut out of a contentious hearing on the proposed demolition of Portland's reservoirs in Washington Park.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, May 28th, 2015. I'm Robert Barncord.
And I'm Sarika Mehta. Environmental groups around the country have declared a major victory as the Obama administration announced a measure to restore Clean Water Act protections for small waterways. For more, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Ricky Seguin, the State Director of Environment Oregon.
Ricky, could you tell us about the significance of the latest order from the Obama administration on the protection of small waterways?
Yesterday was a really exciting day, not just for the waterways in Oregon, but for all of the waterways nationally, when the Obama administration finalized the EPA's Clean Water Rule. And these small streams and headwaters have been vulnerable to pollution and development since the 2000s, after a couple of Supreme Court decisions that left them vulnerable to pollution. So by finalizing this rule, we're taking a huge step forward in restoring protections to our waterways and ensuring that we have clean water well into the future.
Well, any person with a basic knowledge of how water systems work know that small waterways feed into larger ones. How is it that the small waterways were exempted from environmental protections at all?
You know, I am right there with you. It seems like a pretty basic thing you learn in elementary school, that the health of the smaller waterways directly affects the health of the large rivers that we depend upon. But really, that's where the power of polluting special interests becomes most apparent. They were able to say that because a couple of definitions were unclear, that they shouldn't have to follow the law, they shouldn't have their pollution be regulated in the smaller waterways. And it's taken 10 years worth of hard work to get this issue front and center with the EPA and with the Obama administration. And yesterday was a huge victory when the rule was finalized. And now the larger waterways that already have protection under the Clean Water Act will actually be allowed to be clean, because the smaller waterways that feed into them now will receive that same protection again. I think this victory is a really shining example of what hard work and grassroots organizing can do to bring an issue really to the forefront and make real change. On this issue alone, last year the EPA introduced this rule back in March of 2014, and following the introduction of the rule, they received 800,000 public comments supporting that the work that they were doing. And in the middle of all the drama that we're seeing happening in Congress and numerous attacks to weaken the EPA's authority and sort of take the wind out of their strides, having that public support at their back, I really think, is what allowed the EPA and now the Obama administration to follow through on such a critical, critical piece of legislation. And it should be noted that Oregon was very present in that discussion. Here in Oregon, over 40,000 public comments were submitted to the EPA. Over 100 small businesses joined in and voiced their support for the Clean Water Rule. And we've seen real vocal support from our two and supporting the EPA's rulemaking.
Well, speaking of Congress, is there a chance that congressional action could derail this Clean Water Rule? There have been a number of such actions in the past to try and ensure that polluters are still able to dump into small streams.
Yeah, what we're fearful of now, what a very real possibility before us is that Congress will attempt to roll back this rule. So, in fact, just 2 weeks ago, the U.S. House of Representatives passed a measure to severely weaken the EPA's ability to actually enforce this rule. And a big fight is going to take place in the U.S. Senate to make sure that, ideally, no Congressional Review Act takes place. That's where the Senate could review the rule and vote to eliminate it. But then if, in fact, they do proceed down that route, we feel confident that we'll have the support needed to uphold a presidential veto because President Obama will likely veto their attempt to roll back this rule.
Well, thanks so much. I've been speaking with Ricky Seguin. She is the state director for Environment Oregon. Been talking about the new rule that has been just announced by the Obama administration to protect small waterways as part of the Clean Water Act, which they had that protection in the past, and it was removed in the early 2000s. So it's reinstating protection for small waterways from dumping and pollution. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
Portland police and fire officials responded to a, quote, hazardous material leak in Northeast Sandy Boulevard earlier this morning. According to Lieutenant Damon Simmons, a Fire Bureau spokesman, a tank of liquid nitrogen was overfilled, resulting in a, quote, cloud of vapor. While liquid nitrogen can cause burns and asphyxiation in high concentrations, there have been no injuries reported as a result of this leak. According to the Oregonian, after a brief closure of Northeast Sandy Boulevard between 170th and 172nd, responders stopped the leak quickly.
With Oregon's diesel emissions being the sixth highest in the nation, attempts to pass laws that might put the state's limits on par with California's have stalled in the legislature. Because of the lack of limits on diesel emissions, activists are concerned that Oregon has become a dumping ground for vehicles and engines that would be illegal elsewhere. California's strict limitations have been a particular problem. One in five newly registered diesel trucks in Oregon this year were sent from California, where they would not meet standards. Particulate matter spread by the burning of diesel has been linked to numerous health problems, with resulting health care costs estimated at $3.5 billion per year. Organizations of healthcare workers and community groups are pressing for new legislation, since there is a strong financial incentive for private companies to use older, dirtier diesel engines, and they seem unlikely to self-regulate. KBOO's Nathan Behensky spoke with Mary Pavedo of Neighbors for Clean Air about the campaign for tougher standards.
Mary, could you just tell us briefly about the health problems that are caused by the diesel output that we have here in Oregon?
Yes, Oregon has a really disturbing legacy of dirty diesel engines that is attributed to 460 deaths annually every year in Oregon, and countless other negative health outcomes that cost our state $3.5 billion a year. And we currently, the state of Oregon has the sixth highest diesel particulate emissions in the nation, with Multnomah County the fourth highest of all counties in the nation. So we have this legacy of not addressing the old dirty diesel engines effectively.
Yes. Just tell us how it is that Oregon ends up with so many high-output diesel engines here.
Really, the reason is because the federal government only provides emission standards for new engines that are manufactured. So any new engine that was manufactured after really 2007, although the latest standard is 2010, is extremely clean. And the federal government has done, EPA has done an excellent job at pushing the manufacturing standards. Unfortunately, the federal government is precluded from regulating the use of the old dirty diesel engines, the legacy fleets. And this is where states have discretion. And unfortunately, Oregon has not exercised any of that discretion. And one of the problems that we're really seeing make this worse is the fact that our neighbors are doing a much better job, particularly California. So California has outlawed the use of all the older dirty diesel engines pre-2007 that do not have diesel retrofit particulate filters added on aftermarket. And what we're finding is that Oregon is actually ending up importing, becoming a dumping ground for those old dirty diesel engines. So our problem is only set to get worse as California laws take full effect this year.
And we have right now some legislation that you guys have been supporting. Senate Bill 824 is set to set up a committee, as I understand, to investigate the issue.
I have to say that, you know, I'm a bit disappointed by our effort at the state legislature this year. The work on diesel is not a new one, and it was addressed by our state, you know, really almost 10 years ago, and was identified particularly in the Portland metro area as a significant risk to human health
caused by the problem of so much diesel in the Multnomah County and in the Portland metro area. This session, we had really hoped, because on top of already understanding the longstanding problem of the amount of diesel that we had, we also had this extra impetus in to do something in 2015 because of the new California rules taking effect and the understanding of Oregon being vulnerable and already demonstrated that we are the dumping ground for California dirty diesel. So we really expected for our state legislature to step up and take action to ensure that we would not be an open market for dirty diesel engines in our state. So we fell very, very short of that goal. But we did have a really strong engagement conversation with legislators. We had a great opportunity to educate folks about the need for something. And so we are coming out of this session. We hope, it hasn't passed yet, that Senate Bill 824 will be a task force group, interim task force group, so that we will have be ready to go with the next pass mission standard in our state. But you know what? We're not there, and there's a lot of shenanigans still happening with the state legislature, and a lot of bartering and really, until you've got a bill, you don't have a bill. So we really do need people to step up and call their state legislator. Call the governor. The governor really needs to take a stand on this issue, and demonstrate that this is a priority for her. We have a petition online still through change.org that can be found at our website, www.whatsinourair.org. I encourage people, they can get hold of me directly. Would love to have folks helping get the message out that this is important to them.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for your interest.
That was KBOO's Nathan Behensky speaking with Mary Pavedo of Neighbors for Clean Air.
Two federal agencies have reached an agreement to delay the cleanup of Hanford nuclear waste dump until the year 2019. The U.S. Department of Energy, which owns the site, was supposed to finish the cleanup by September of 2014, last year. They missed that deadline, and the radioactive nuclear sludge remains in a basin that drains into the Columbia River. Now, instead of pushing the Energy Department to complete the cleanup immediately, the EPA has agreed to allow the sludge to remain for another 4 years. This is despite the fact that the director of the EPA's Superfund site has listed the Hanford nuclear waste as one of its top priorities, since Hanford is the nation's most polluted nuclear weapons production site. It is the site where much of the country's nuclear arsenal was built during the 1940s and 50s. In addition to the decades of nuclear weapons waste on the site, nuclear waste continues to be generated by a nuclear energy plant known as the Columbia Generating Station. That nuclear plant is currently offline for a month for refueling, and activists have launched a campaign to keep it offline indefinitely in order to address a crack in the jet pump in the reactor core.
Cyclists from around the West converge on Malheur County in southeastern Oregon next month for what has become known as a welcoming rural ride for a deserving cause. The Great Owyhee Ride Against Hunger attracts novice and expert cyclists, and even families, with five different routes that range from 15 to 100 miles. Entry fees are donated to Oregon Food Bank's Southeastern Oregon Services. KBOO reporter Khalil has more on the story in collaboration with the Oregon News Service.
Cyclists in the Great Owyhee Ride Against Hunger accomplished two worthy goals, eating their long-distance challenge and being part of Oregon Food Bank's hunger fighting efforts. About 300 people are expected to bring their bikes this year for the June 20th event, which begins in Ontario and winds through Vail and rural Mohair County. The first sign-up deadline is this Friday, May 29th. Organizers Kevin Gold says in 9 years, the Great Owyhee Ride has gained a reputation for taking good care of the riders.
We want to be there for the riders, and we want them to be able to push their limits a little bit and be able to succeed. So we offer 8 rest stops over the course of 100 miles, which is pretty much unheard of. Most century routes, if you hit 4, you're doing really well.
The longer routes, the Sentry or 100-mile ride and a metric Sentry of about 65 miles takes riders to the base of the Hawaii Dam. Last year's ride raised $7,500 for Oregon Food Bank partners in Harney and Mohair counties, which supplies about 30,000 pounds of food. GOES says to accommodate riders of all abilities, including kids, there also are 15, 30, and 50-mile routes. He adds this year's charitable goal is $10,000.
We try to cover all our expenses with sponsor fees, so we can tell a rider your entry fee, 100% of that is going to go to the food bank. They also have an opportunity to, there's a box they can check to add additional monies that go straight to the food bank.
Routes and registration details are on the Great Hawaii Ride Against Hunger website, greathawaiiride.com. For KBOO News, I'm Khalil.
An inmate was declared dead in the Yamhill County Jail after reporting a medical problem. According to the Yamhill County Sheriff's Office spokesman, the inmate was transferred from his cell upon his report of a medical issue to a medical observation cell. The inmate seemed to be in distress around 1 a.m., as reported by the Oregonian. The deputies present then performed CPR and called the McMinnville paramedics. The paramedics were unable to get a response from the inmate. He was pronounced dead at the site. The inmate's identity is not being released until the relatives have been notified. And the state medical examiner has planned an autopsy to determine the cause of this death.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News in Depth, followed by Rose City Native Radio at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective, followed by Guess Who's Coming to Radio at 8, featuring Portland education activist Ron Herndon, the director of Albina Head Start and chairman of the board of the National Head Start Association. Tomorrow's weather will be mostly sunny with clouds in the evening, with a high of 83 and a low of 55. Today in history, in 1830, President Andrew Jackson signed the Indian Relocation Act, resulting in the removal of Indian tribes from most of the southeastern United States to reservations west of the Mississippi via the Trail of Tears. In 1871, John Muir founded the Sierra Club in San Francisco. And today marks the Pakistani holiday of Yom-e-Takbir, or Day of Greatness, which celebrates a successful nuclear test in 1998 conducted in response to Indian tests 17 days earlier. The quote of the day is from Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, who began the country's nuclear program in 1972 as president and was executed after the coup of 1979, who wrote in a letter to his daughter Benazir Bhutto, "I would be the happiest man if the gloomy winter of mankind were to give way to a shaft of sunlight and to colored flowers. The world is very beautiful."
Hey, it's 22 minutes after 5 and time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
At last, America's political leaders indicate that they now feel the pain of the poor and of the millions of working families slipping out of the middle class. Congress had previously paid no attention to the ever-widening chasm between the rich and the rest of us, but it has recently emerged as a central issue for such Republican presidential contenders as Jeb Bush, Ted Cruz, Rand Paul, and Marco Rubio. They're publicly lamenting the wealth gap and, by gollies, proposing solutions. Alas, though, the solution proposed by each of them is not to provide help for those who've been knocked down, but to offer aid to the same corporate elites who've been knocking down the middle class and holding down the poor. Specifically, their solution is to cut taxes on corporations and the rich, do away with environmental and labor protections, and cut or privatize government programs, from Head Start to Social Security, that ordinary people count on. For example, Senator Rubio proposes to kill the food stamp program, even though the need for it is greater than ever, and redirect that money into what he calls a subsidy for low-wage workers. Does he think we have sucker wrappers around our heads? That's not a subsidy for workers, but for low-wage employers. Why should taxpayers subsidize the poverty pay of profitable giants like McDonald's, rather than making them pay living wages and cover their own labor costs? This is Jim Hightower saying, I guess we should count it as progress that candidates are at least having to admit that inequality is a problem. But come on, offering the same old failed anti-government snake oil is an insult to the American people. Jeb Bush shows how vacuous their flim-flammery is by saying that to address the ever-widening wealth and income gap, he'll, quote, celebrate success and cherish free enterprise. Gosh, what a comfort that'll be to America's hard-hit majority, huh?
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out at hightowerlowdown.org.
Texas legislature will consider an amendment that will affect the open carry laws in the Lone Star State. The amendment would prohibit police officers from requesting information or permits from people openly carrying guns without another cause. Supporters of the amendment claim it will reduce racial profiling by the police. Texas Senator Don Huffins also says it will allow citizens to fully exercise their Second Amendment rights. The opposition claims the amendment severely impairs the police force's ability to protect the community. Despite large turnout of opposition, the amendment passed the Texas Senate with a large majority, but was stalled in the House. The so-called no-stop amendment was sent to committee for revision before returning to the Senate and the House for another vote.
A rally is scheduled for tomorrow night outside a mosque and community center in Phoenix, Arizona. Organizers say it's in response to the attack earlier this month on a, quote, draw the prophet contest held in Garland, Texas, in which two gunmen were killed by police outside the event. The gunmen had declared their allegiance to ISIS, the militant group seizing territory in Syria and Iraq, for a self-declared Islamic caliphate, and both had previously attended the Islamic Community Center of Phoenix, or ICCP, which is where tomorrow's rally is scheduled to be held. Attendees and leaders at ICCP expressed their shock after the Garland shooting, stating that both men had never expressed any violent rhetoric or intentions while attending the mosque. The rally is being organized via the Facebook page Freedom of Speech Rally Round 2 by the biker John Ritzheimer, and more than 300 people have said they will attend. The biker group, Riders United for the Sovereignty of America, is reportedly involved in this. KBOO tried to contact their offices but got no response before airtime. The Facebook page states that attendees are, quote, encouraged to exercise their Second Amendment right in case our First Amendment comes under the much expected attack, end quote. The event will also include a contest for cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad, and attendees are encouraged to bring signs and shout slogans that express their displeasure with the events in Garland and Islam in general. The Arizona branch of the Council on American Islamic Relations, or CAIR, has coordinated with local police to make sure the rally does not turn violent. For more on this, KBOO's Sam Bowman spoke to Liban Yusuf, the civil rights director of CAIR Arizona.
So this is not the first rally that has been held by anti-Islam groups at specifically at the Islamic Community Center in Phoenix. There was one held on May 17th, and has that been the biggest such rally so far, and what was it like?
Yeah, so that the first rally, it wasn't too big, and it was a very, very low-key. As a community, the leadership at that mosque decided to not publicize it, not make it a big deal. It was held outside of regular service hours, so much of the community weren't even at the mosque at the time. So it went pretty much under the radar, both within the community and media at large. From my understanding, I wasn't there, but it wasn't too much people there. Of course, you know, they came under obscene T-shirts, screaming epithets and things like that. But for the most part, it went smoothly. There wasn't much community members there to taunt or anything like that. And they just went on their way.
And do you expect it to be different this time, given that it's occurring on during Friday prayers?
Yeah, I mean, we're expecting it to be, number one, a lot larger, because now this is it drew national attention, and I think that was part of the protesters' plan, is to, you know, to get a lot more attention to this. And what we're actually seeing is that there's a lot of people from other states even posting on the the Facebook event page talking about we support you. We'll be out there. But again, our advice to the community has just been the same. Just ignore these people. Don't engage with them in any way. They're threatening to bring weapons. They're threatening violence against the community. So again, we just our number one priority is the safety of the community.
Has there been any sort of civil communication with anybody among the protesters?
No, not on our end. I believe it was an article or some video where the organizer said he reached out to the mosque. I can't confirm that, and the mosque leadership never mentioned anything about that. But, I mean, that's what they're claiming on their end.
Have relations between the people that the protesters are representing, sort of the anti-Islamic, anti-immigration community, and have relations between them and the Islamic community in Arizona, have you noticed that they've gotten worse since the shooting in Garland, Texas, or has it always been a little tense?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's always been vocal Islamophobic element here within the state and within the valley. There's always some little event going on. They've definitely been, inflamed with the Garland shootings. Our community came out. We condemned it. We condemned the shootings. We condemned the act of violence to try to defend the honor of our prophet. But again, it's not enough for them that they feel that they have to come out and put this blanket suspicion on our community and, again, threatening the same mosque and other mosques in the valley. Just a few days ago, received threatening letters, threatening the imams, threatening their families with very specifics that we know where you live, we're coming for you, we're coming for your family, we're going to burn down your mosque when it's full, things like that. So it's definitely been inflamed, and it's something that we're monitoring very closely, and we're in communication with law enforcement about it.
And can you talk a little bit about your cooperation with law enforcement on this?
Yeah, so in regards to the letters, I mean, both of them have been reported to local law enforcement and as well as to the FBI. They're both investigating it. Both agencies are investigating these letters to see. I know the FBI just recently came out publicly and said that it is a credible threat that they're taking very seriously. And just yesterday, me personally and others from our organization, CARE Arizona, we met with Phoenix Police and we met with the FBI. Who again reassured us about this protest, that there'll be ample security there. They gave us the advice to tell our community to avoid them because there might be a violent element involved. And, it just takes one unhinged person who's armed to turn this into a tragedy. So we definitely want to avoid that. Our law enforcement has been really good on this. They're the ones who tipped us off initially about the initial protest a while back. And they've been contacting us and updating us on everything.
Liban Yusuf, thank you very much for your comment today.
No problem. It's good to talk to you.
For KBOO Evening News, this is Sam Bowman speaking with Liban Yusuf, Civil Rights Director at CARE Arizona.
Conflicting accounts of a police shooting in Florida continue to widen the rift between communities and law enforcement. 26-year-old Justin Way was killed after his girlfriend Kristen Lyons called a non-emergency number for help when Justin said he was feeling suicidal. She told the dispatcher that she did not feel threatened. Sheriffs soon arrived armed with assault rifles, and moments later, Justin Way was shot dead. Way's parents said a detective described the incident involving their son as a trend in law enforcement called suicide by cop, in which suicidal people allegedly provoke authorities in order to bring about their own death. The family contends that investigators refused to disclose how many times Way was shot, but one of the deputies involved wrote on social networking sites that, quote, "While most respect the badge, all respect the gun." Today, a federal appeals court affirmed that a person threatening to commit suicide has a constitutional right to not be shot on sight if that person is not putting anyone else in imminent danger or resisting arrest for a serious crime.
A coalition of groups co-signed an open letter calling on the lead negotiator for the Trans-Pacific Partnership to disclose the record of his communications with the nation's 10 largest banks. The request implores United States Trade Representative Michael Froman to consider transparency as a means to secure the public's trust. The group also expressed concerns about the lesser-known Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, the TTIP, and the potential to weaken the framework adopted by the United States to regulate the financial services industry in the wake of 2008's economic crisis. Some cause for the scrutiny is about Froman's past as a board member of Citigroup, who, according to the Center for Responsive Politics, spent more than $11 million lobbying Congress during the last election cycle, and more than 80% of the 61 lobbyists on staff have previously held positions in the government.
And now we turn to the weekly commentary from Paul Cienfuegos for Community Rights and Dismantling Corporate Rule, produced weekly for the KBOO Evening News.
Greetings. You are listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos, normally heard on Tuesdays, but this week it's on Wednesday. Yesterday in Salem, Oregon, there was a statewide rally on the Capitol steps in opposition to the LNG export terminals in Coos Bay and Astoria, and hundreds of miles of new pipelines across private lands, all being proposed by a number of large corporations. The rally was organized by the No LNG Exports Coalition. As is so often the case for me, as I listened to the way that the issue was being framed by the rally organizers over the past few days on various radio interviews, I found myself cringing. Why? Because, as usual, all of the activist groups involved in this rally and in the anti-LNG coalition are stuck in a kind of activism that by its very design disempowers and further confuses the public about where real political power ultimately resides. When we rally, when we march, when we picket, when we sign petitions, when we beg and demand and plead with our elected and appointed government leaders and with our corporate leaders, what we are in effect telling them and telling ourselves is that we see ourselves as powerless. We see ourselves as outside of decision-making authority. We see ourselves as not capable of participating in planning the future we want for our own communities. In other words, those people are the only decision makers that count, not us. When I hear that kind of message from activist groups, I get nauseous, I get sad, I get angry. Why are our own activist groups leading us towards such disempowering forms of citizen participation? Here are some examples of what I've been listening to on KBOO Radio these past few days about the LNG issue. First, here's Dan Saris with Columbia Riverkeeper, who was interviewed on Chris Andre's show yesterday morning. He said, quote, "Today we're getting together on the Capitol steps to send a clear message to Governor Brown. She has a lot of authority and a lot of power, and we're hoping that she wields it to protect our farms, our forests, and our rivers from liquefied natural gas," unquote. In other words, we're putting all of our eggs in one basket, and that basket is Governor Kate Brown. But what happens if our new governor chooses not to stop the LNG projects? Then what? Is there a plan B? More rallies in Salem? Is that really the best we can do? Here's another voice, Sarah Westover, LNG organizer in Southern Oregon with Rogue Riverkeeper, also on Chris Andre's show. She had an almost identical message, quote, "We are hoping that our governor will stand with Oregonians in taking action to stop energy companies from dictating the way we do business in Oregon and lead us to a clean energy future," unquote. Why is taking action almost always associated with we the people begging and pleading with our so-called leaders? And is it really the best we can do simply to hope that our new governor stands with us against the LNG projects? And why do the people of Oregon continue to allow energy companies to dictate the way we do business here? Does Sarah not know that energy companies only have the decision-making authority they wield because they exercise their corporate constitutional so-called rights in a way that trumps our rights? Here again is Dan Saris, the conservation director at Columbia Riverkeeper, being interviewed by Barbara Bernstein on Monday. Quote, "We're going to march to the Department of State Lands, and there people will share their stories about why that's an agency that's really powerful. Landowners will speak to the fact that they wish they had the authority that DSL has to say no. They can't say, you can't put that pipeline through my stream on my land, but DSL can," unquote. Dan clearly doesn't realize that the Department of Public Lands, a regulatory agency, does not have the legitimate authority to force a private landowner to allow a corporate pipeline to be built across their land. The entire regulatory agency system was originally set up to shield corporate decision-making from an outraged citizenry, and here we have just the latest example of how well the system is working to further corporate interests. We need to be dismantling these agencies, not bowing to their authority. And finally, here's a brief excerpt from the press release for yesterday's rally. Quote, "During the rally, the public will call on Oregon decision-makers to use the state's power to protect Oregon from LNG projects," unquote. Now hold on just 1 minute. The public will call on Oregon decision-makers to protect Oregon. Does this coalition not understand who the leading decision-makers are in Oregon? It's us. It's the people of Oregon. We are the sovereign people. Let's review the very first paragraph of our Oregon State Constitution. Article 1, Bill of Rights, Section 1, Natural Rights Inherent in People. We declare that all power is inherent in the people and all free governments are founded on their authority and instituted for their peace, safety, and happiness. And they have, at all times, a right to alter, reform, or abolish the government in such manner as they may think proper, unquote. In other words, we already have the authority to protect our human and non-human communities from destructive LNG terminals and pipelines. So let's stop begging and start deciding. Thank goodness there is already a model for us to follow. It's the community rights model. There are now active community rights groups in 8 Oregon counties that are learning to exercise their right of self-government. In Coos County, the Coos Commons Protection Council has filed a ballot initiative that would prohibit the proposed LNG pipeline and export terminal. It's called the Right to a Sustainable Energy Future Ordinance. It would secure the right of the people of Coos County to be the decision makers about their energy future. The ordinance would protect the rights of people and ecosystems in the county from non-sustainable energy projects, including current corporate and government attempts to push through the pipeline and export terminal. It would not only prohibit the siting of such projects, but also prohibit the use of eminent domain, the taking of private property, on behalf of foreign and domestic oil and gas corporations. And the Columbia County Sustainable Action for Green Energy Group has similar plans. Their Sustainable Energy Future Ordinance will, among other things, prohibit coal and oil trains from passing through their county. Isn't this a more empowering political process for citizens to participate in, rather than merely hoping that our new governor and state agencies will protect us? In both Coos and Columbia County, residents are taking back their authority to govern themselves and to protect their own health and welfare, regardless of what our state and corporate so-called leaders are planning for us. These groups need your support. I encourage you to visit their website at coozcommons.org and at ccsage.org. That's ccsage.org. Wouldn't it be great if sometime in the not-too-distant future, conventional activist groups began to follow the lead of Oregon's growing collection of counties, working to pass community rights ordinances? Let's stop pleading with our so-called leaders and get on with the job of protecting our communities directly, as we the people of Oregon. You've been listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. You can hear future commentaries every Tuesday on the KBOO Evening News in Portland, Oregon, and on a growing number of other radio stations. I welcome your feedback. You can subscribe to my weekly podcast via iTunes or at communityrightspdx.org. You can follow me on Twitter at cienfuegospaul. You can sign up for my newsletter at paulcienfuegos.com. Thanks for listening, and remember, we are the people we've been waiting for.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast. We encourage your participation. You can call us with your breaking news stories here at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Nathan Behensky, Khalil, Catherine Maticek, and Robin Ryan. The producer is Sam Bowman. Our engineer is Matthew Olson. And the KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Yanka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Robert Barncourt.
And I'm Sari Gametha. Coming up tomorrow on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now with award-winning journalists Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Positively Revolting, Lynn hosts topics from an eco-feminist and anarcho-feminist perspective. At 9, on Political Perspectives, Kathleen Stevenson hosts. Her guest is activist Ai-Jen Poo, talking about her new book, The Age of Dignity, Preparing for the Elder Boom in a Changing America. At 9:30, Don Merrill interviews Martin Ford. At 10, Air Cascadia is off. Instead, we'll hear a full hour of Flashpoints Investigative News Radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11 on the Radio Zine, Kathleen Stevenson talks with Charles Fishman, author of The Big Thirst, The Secret Life and Turbulent Future of Water, about how water has shaped our past and how new water challenges are shaping the future. At 11:30, we hear an episode of The Scholar Circle with host Maria Armudian. Thanks for listening to KBOO, and thank you KBOO members for your generous support. If you are not a member, you can become one. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In-Depth. Good night, Robert.
Good night, Sarika.
Good night, Matthew.
Good night.
KBOO News In-Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Portland's open reservoirs were the topic of a hearing today at the City Council meeting, but many people who wanted to attend the hearing were shut out as the City Council decided to close the balcony and strictly enforce rules on proper decorum in City Council after disruptions at last week's hearing on the reservoirs. Portland's unique reservoir system, according to the local group Friends of Reservoirs, exemplify a wise use resource plan, blending utility with natural preservation and public recreation. Built during the Progressive Era, the group says they were designed within the ethics of the City Beautiful movement, which brought about a period of American development that purposefully made public works beautiful as a means to raise living standards. In 2006, the Environmental Protection Agency put in place rules known as LT2,